Good afternoon. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. And I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum program today. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs featuring outstanding speakers on major social, economic, and foreign policy issues, especially as they may relate to important new books. And today is certainly no exception. For those of you new to the Institute, you'll find background information in the packets at your seat. The Independent Institute is a non-politicized, non-profit, scholarly research and educational foundation. We sponsor about 6 to 10 books per year on many major public issues. Our program seeks to adhere to the highest standards of independent inquiry, and the resulting studies are widely distributed as books and other publications. And they form the basis for numerous conference and media programs that we hold here and around the country. Our purpose is essentially a Jeffersonian one of seeking truth regarding the impact of government policies, and not necessarily to tell people what they might just want to hear. In doing so, we will not take the public pronouncements of government officials at face value, nor the conventional wisdom necessarily over serious public problems. Hence, we invite your participation, but be prepared for new and challenging perspectives. We neither seek nor accept government funding. The Institute draws the support from a diverse range of foundations, businesses, and individuals, and we invite you also to become a member. There's also information about membership in your packet. And for those of you not familiar with some of our books, our most recent book, Out of Work, is available as a premium. Also, related to today's topic, you might be interested in the book, Arms, Politics, and the Economy, that we produced fairly recently on the defense establishment. There's also a synopsis of the book in your packet as well. Our program today couldn't be more timely. Despite this week's congressional clamor for withdrawal, an increasingly bloody, escalating intervention in Somalia is showing that the use of military intervention by the Clinton administration, like the Bush administration before it, is likely to continue to be a common feature of American foreign policy. Today we've learned that an additional 5,000 troops with heavy equipment will be sent to Somalia for quote-unquote non-military purposes. But will the Clinton administration, like the Bush administration, allow the military to keep American journalists from doing their jobs if the shooting increases and American forces take increased casualties? Will the Clinton administration seek to limit the role of the press, as was done in the Gulf War, to that of glorified government stenographers, should its interventions turn bloody, as has already happened in Somalia? Furthermore, what happens when government goes unchallenged, and when questions regarding present and proposed domestic and international policies go unasked? To understand how government officials may seek to shift and control public opinion, our speaker today is found understanding the precedent set during the war with Saddam Hussein to be most insightful. In his presentation, our speaker will draw upon his widely acclaimed book, Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, to scrutinize the government's campaign to tightly control the American media during Operation Desert Storm. Policies that can be traced through decades of press-government relations, including that developed in the military operations in Vietnam and especially in Grenada and Panama. And I hope that each of you will take with you today a copy of the superb book. It has just within the last week come out in a rather inexpensive softcover edition with a new afterword. In his talk, our speaker will detail behind-the-scenes activities during Operation Desert Storm by the U.S. and Kuwaiti governments, as well as the media's being co-opted while its rights to observe, question, and report were heavily restricted far beyond any needs to protect American lives. As a result, from left to right, there resulted in a virtual and complete cave-in by the media over the events, policies, and even simple facts during the Gulf crisis. For example, as reported in the September's issue of the Washington Monthly, Within minutes after a Norman Schwarzkopf Gulf War briefing, in which the general showed the press an Air Force film that he said depicted the destruction of 7 Iraqi Scud missiles, he was told that the CIA believed that they were oil tanker trucks, not Scuds. The general never corrected the record, and in a House Armed Services Committee report recently released, it states, quote, a post-war review of photographs could not produce even a single confirmed kill of a Scud missile, unquote. In a similar vein, where the general claimed that Iraq had 623,000 soldiers in the Kuwaiti theater, post-war army estimates put Iraqi strength at roughly 300,000, and the same House Committee report puts the figure at 183,000. The Allies, meanwhile, had a total of 700,000 troops. It has been said that truth is the first casualty of war, and the history of war-making certainly bears this out. History has indeed been largely written by the victors, and anyone acquainted with the Bayeux Tapestry of William the Conqueror knows the lengths to which a state will go to justify war atrocities. And in the American experience, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, all depended upon extensive government propaganda campaigns. The World War I journalist Randolph Bourne correctly stated that, quote, war is the health of the state. And it is to counter that this total power that a free, independent, non-governmental press is so crucial. Our speaker today could not be better qualified or more incisive in addressing the pressing civil liberties questions we face. In addition, he was strongly influenced by the late Walter Karp, whose work in journalism and war has scarcely been equaled. Rick MacArthur is in the investigative and muckraking and journalistic tradition of both H.L. Mencken and I.F. Stone. As you know, he's the publisher of Harper's Magazine. His book, Second Front, was selected by the New York Times Book Review Committee as one of the notable books of the year. Before joining Harper's, Mr. MacArthur was assistant foreign editor for United Press International and had been a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, the Bergen Record, Washington Star, and the Wall Street Journal. In 1986, Mr. MacArthur co-founded Article 19, the International Center on Censorship, which is based in London. Mr. MacArthur holds a bachelor's degree in history from Columbia University, and he is a fellow at the New York Institute for the Humanities and a director of the Authors Guild and the Committee to Protect Journalists. I'm very pleased to introduce him now to speak on censorship and propaganda in the Gulf War, how government can mold public opinion, after which he'll be happy to answer questions. May I present Rick MacArthur.
What a nice introduction. Thank you very much. I hope none of you think I'm a humorless left-wing media critic. I come out of a tradition of reporting which is probably fast disappearing, I'm afraid. One of my mentors at United Press International was a very odd survivor of the Beat Generation named Lucien Carr. And one day I was working on the foreign desk, the cables desk as we called it, at UPI. And I had sent over a story with a lead paragraph, which Lou decided was not sufficient to excite the interest of what we call telegraph editors at newspapers around the country. And he sort of ambled over to the cables desk and he said, gentlemen, make me cry or make me horny. And that was sort of the world I grew up in, a newspaper business that didn't take itself nearly as seriously as it takes itself now, and I would argue is was a much better, livelier business than it's become. I'm anxious to hear your questions, so I'm going to try to get to that as quickly as possible. I don't know how much you know about my reporting or about the book, so I'll try to give you a quick summation of what the book is about and what I was trying to do. But to begin, to back up an argument, or my arguments, I always prefer a literary reference to a historical one. That is when I can get away with it. And having recently, during my summer vacation, and gratefully overcome my phobia about Henry James, I had the good fortune to discover two terrifically useful quotations in one novel, The Portrait of a Lady, that bear directly on the arguments I make in Second Front. In fact, had I known about them 2 years ago, I would have used them in the book. The first quotation deals with the basic attitude of Americans toward war, certainly in the 19th century, but I believe in some ways is still our basic attitude. Bear with me if you know the story of Portrait of a Lady. James's heroine, the young, attractive, and intelligent Isabel Archer, has been pursued by, among other men, a certain Caspar Goodwood, a Massachusetts textile heir of great energy and literal mindedness. In short, a member of the class that I like to refer to as the working rich. James describes him this way, quote, "It always struck people who knew him that he might do greater things than carry on a cotton factory. There was nothing cottony about Caspar Goodwood, and his friends took for granted that he would not always content himself with that. He had once said to Isabel that if the United States were only not such a confoundedly peaceful nation, he would find his proper place in the army." Now, in the Gulf War story, George Bush plays a version of Caspar Goodwood, the son of a New England political and business, of the New England political and business aristocracy, desperate to prove himself in war again and again and again, trying to overcome the confoundedly peaceful tendencies of his fellow citizens, which stand in the way of his enormous ambition. Now, another character in the novel is Isabel's great friend, Henrietta Stackpole. Henrietta is as straightforward and energetic as Goodwood, but her trade is journalism, and she's constantly trying to tell Isabel the truth, which is the very bad news that the man Isabel eventually marries is a selfish, narrow-minded prig. Now, regarding the husband's poor opinion of her, of Henrietta, James quotes Henrietta this way, quote, "I don't know and I don't care. He is perfectly welcome not to like me. I don't want everyone to like me. I should think less of myself if some people did. A journalist can't hope to do much good unless he gets a good deal hated. That's the way he knows how his work goes on." Henrietta, who writes for the New York Interviewer, speaks in the honest journalistic idiom displayed in my book by Dan Rather, who denounces the new era of what he calls suck-up journalism. He describes to me how he's become an alien in a world in which his bosses urge him to become more likable, not hated, but more likable. Rather can remember the day not so long ago when reporters were rewarded for being more like Henrietta Stackpole. Now, would that these 19th century assumptions about America, fundamentally peaceful and protected from the Caspar Goodwoods by a fiercely independent and rambunctious press, still applied in the present day? Sadly, they don't. On the one hand, we have, in the Gulf War story, a president of great energy and ambition, who drags his reluctant countrymen into war through a carefully orchestrated and largely fraudulent public relations campaign. Standing between Bush and his ambition should have been a whole army of Henrietta Stackpoles asking unpleasant and probing questions. In 1881, it could be assumed that most reporters and publishers would have generally agreed with Henrietta's assessment of the journalist's destiny to be hated. But what Bush encountered in the late 20th century instead was a group of tame and timid press agents incapable or unwilling, for the most part, of doing even the most basic sort of police reporting, not to mention asking probing and intelligent questions about foreign policy, foreign countries, war and peace, et cetera, et cetera. Worse still, Bush found among the media a cadre of, quote, journalists, unquote, who did their best to help him perpetrate the propaganda that proved so successful in driving this country into the Gulf War. Now, I'll assume that most of you haven't, read my book and summarize what I think are the three great frauds produced by the White House, with the cooperation, eager or passive, depending on your point of view, of the U.S. media. Now, first, we have the campaign to prove that Saddam Hussein was the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler, rather than what he is, which is a violent Arab dictator of the sort that the U.S. frequently likes to back. Now, a subset of this campaign was to paint the Kuwaitis as a freedom-loving people moving inexorably toward democracy. Now, the way this was done, very straightforward, very sophisticated stuff, which costs a lot of money, was to first form something called Citizens for a Free Kuwait, which of course implies that American citizens are rallying to the Kuwaiti cause from all over the country. Citizens for a Free Kuwait forms itself about a week after Saddam invades Kuwait, and they hire Hill and Knowlton, the public relations firm, and ultimately pays Hill and Knowlton $11 million to do the job. It was one of the most brilliantly orchestrated public relations campaigns in history. It really should go down in the record books, and I'm hoping that someone will do a scholarly book on it someday. I went to visit Citizens for a Free Kuwait, or what was left of it, shortly after the Gulf War ended, a few months after the Gulf War ended, when I'd started research on my book, and I went to see a Mr. El Ibrahim, who was the titular head of CFK. And the first time I realized that there was something fishy going on was when he pulled out a stack of atrocity photographs. And I went through them and I said, gee, this looks pretty awful, you know, people with odd pieces of metal jammed into their bodies in various places. It looked quite horrible, but the photographs were a little out of focus, and I went through them a second time and I looked them more carefully, and I realized that they were mannequins. It literally dressed up mannequins as torture victims. Now, this is not to say that Saddam did not kill Kuwaitis or they didn't torture Kuwaitis, but it became the stock and trade of the Hill and Knowlton campaign. Now, the absolute pièce de résistance of the propaganda campaign, as you may have heard, was the baby incubator atrocity. In August, the word started coming out of Kuwait from anonymous people who were interviewed by reporters who, as I said, did not do the most fundamental police reporting, like asking for last names, addresses, ages, occupations, et cetera, saying that Iraqi soldiers were pulling babies out of incubators and killing them that way in Kuwaiti hospitals. Now, Hill and Knowlton is very well connected on Capitol Hill and at the White House. The senior account people on the Kuwaiti account included Craig Fuller, Bush's former chief of staff when he was vice president, and various other mucky mucks who know how to make things happen on Capitol Hill. And they set up a hearing with the Congressional Human Rights Caucus, chaired by Tom Lantos, a local congressman, and John Edward Porter of Illinois, at which they were going to expose Iraqi atrocities for the benefit of the caucus and the American people. Anyway, there was an incredible conflict of interest between the caucus and Hill and Knowlton, the most important aspect of which was that the Congressional Human Rights Foundation, which was an arm of the caucus, fundraising arm of the caucus, had its offices rent-free in the Hill and Knowlton headquarters. Free space. The Hill and Knowlton executives were also representing habitual human rights violators like Turkey and so on and so forth, in Indonesia and China and so on and so forth. So you might ask yourself what Tom Lantos and Porter are doing allowing this arrangement to go on. Anyway, they were happy to set up the hearing. And the star of the hearing was a young 15-year-old girl named Naira, no last name, no address, no occupation, who said that she'd volunteered at Kuwaiti hospitals and seen 15 babies pulled from incubators and left to die on the cold floor. That's a quote. Now, to this day, I can't tell you whether this story, which turned out to be utterly fake, was manufactured by historically astute public relations executives in collaboration with the Kuwaitis. you know, that they'd read World War I history and seen how successful the Belgian, the German atrocities against Belgian babies and nuns and so on had been in getting public opinion on the side of the Allies and getting the United States into the war, more importantly. But nobody at the hearing, no reporter, said, Naira, that's a terrible story. I'm on the verge of tears. But what did you do after they put the babies on the floor to die? Did you call for help? Did you try to pick one up? What happened then? You know, the most fundamental, most elementary questions that a reporter is supposed to ask were not asked. Naira was a fantastic propaganda success. Helen Knowlton made a brilliant little VNR, a video news release out of it, which they beamed all over the world. It was on NBC Nightly News, et cetera, et cetera. Millions and millions of people. My brother-in-law saw Naira testify, and it brought him to tears. And that was the beginning of the campaign. That was the way that the campaign began to get legs, as we say, in the PR news business. But then they went to the UN, and they did the same thing at the Security Council. There was a certain Dr. Bebahani, who you may remember, who testified that he was a surgeon who had personally overseen the burial of 40 babies pulled from incubators. Turns out that Dr. Bebahani was a dentist, not a surgeon. And he admitted after the war that he'd lied. He'd made the whole thing up. So, but again, it was grist for the PR mill. It was terrifically successful. Every time you put this stuff on camera, and they staged it all very, very professionally, you make a video news release out of it, and WZZZ in San Antonio can just pop it into the console and make it part of their evening news results. So it's got a longer life than just the day of the hearing or the day of the Security Council hearing. It gets used again and again and again as filler for tonight's roundup on Saddam, Hitler, Iraqi atrocities. Now, I just did a little math, and I found out that the polls showed the country divided pretty much 50-50 on sanctions versus war back in December and January of 1991. But when the vote was finally taken in the Senate, you may recall it passed by 5 votes, and in favor of war, 6 senators cited the baby incubator atrocity as a principal reason, sort of a final compelling reason to vote for the resolution over their sort of initial or their instinctive reluctance to go to war. And several others who voted for the resolution said that they thought Iraqi atrocities in general were a good reason to go to war. Now, as you may know now, Naira was not only a liar, but she was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. That's the story I revealed in the New York Times last January of 92, on the op-ed page. So you have the country going to war essentially, I believe, over human rights, not over oil, not over realpolitik, not over America's destiny to police the world, but really over human rights. This is what's, I think, swung the balance, that a good part of the human rights atrocity story was fake. Suggests that we were misled, conned, whatever you want to say. Now, the second part of the second great fraud that I think took place during the Gulf War buildup was, and this is a little more obscure, is the premise for sending troops in the first place. You remember that Bush sent troops in order to defend Saudi Arabia against an invasion or possible invasion from Kuwait by the Iraqis. Now, there were satellite photographs, Russian, Soviet satellite photographs available of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia on September, taken on September 11th and 13th of 1990. Those photographs showed very clearly the American troop concentrations on the Saudi side of the border, showed no Iraqi troop concentrations on the Kuwaiti side of the border, nothing. Several news organizations had access to these photographs, Newsweek, ABC, Chicago Tribune. Sam Donaldson personally looked at them and thought about going with them, and they all spiked the story because they were too scared to publish a story that contradicted what the government was saying, which was essentially that there was a huge number of Iraqi soldiers poised or prepared to invade Saudi Arabia, which of course was the premise for sending the troops. In January, just before the Senate debate on the war resolution, the St. Petersburg Times finally published the photograph. So the only newspaper in the country, St. Petersburg, Florida, the only paper in the country that published these. The wire services didn't pick it up. Television didn't pick it up. If you lived in St. Petersburg, you were the best informed American on the subject of Iraq's threat to Saudi Arabia. And of course, after the famous April Glaspe gaffe, she was called home. You remember what she did? She said to Saddam, we have no objection, or the United States takes no position in border disputes between Arab countries or between Iraq and Kuwait, which some people think encouraged Saddam to invade. In April, a reporter caught her on the fly walking down the street and said, how did you manage to screw up so badly, April? And she said, quote, we didn't think he'd take the whole thing, unquote. So this suggested to me that I strongly believe that the invasion threat was fake. I really do. And even Schwarzkopf in his autobiography skirts the question. He's very careful because I think he's afraid that evidence may come out at some point that the invasion threat wasn't what we had said it was. And he says that, so if you read his autobiography, you'll see that he says, even if the Iraqis weren't intending to invade Saudi Arabia, it was a good thing to go after them. Now, the third canard, I think, is the nuclear threat. You'll recall there was a great deal said about Saddam's nuclear capability and quite a bit of hysterical posturing on that subject. I did a little research, and I found out from a very, very reliable government source, it's public if you want to see it, that the estimates on Saddam's potential for building a crude atomic bomb that could actually or conceivably used range from 2 weeks to 15 years, if you put together all the expert opinion on it. Now, I've said I've thought since I started looking into this, that first of all, the economic embargo made it impossible for him to complete work on the bomb, even if he was aggressively trying to do it, and even if he has the capability. The second factor that people didn't discuss, of course, was Seymour Hersh's revelation that the Israelis have 300 nuclear warheads and are perfectly prepared to use them if necessary. You know that during the war in 74 with Egypt, Golda Meir actually said that we prepared the military for a nuclear strike on Egypt. And you have to remember the Israelis had already taken out a nuclear reactor in 81 in Baghdad. So the idea that the world was going to sit by and let Saddam build a bomb and use it is tenuous, but with a full-blown economic blockade on Iraq, it doesn't seem very plausible that he could complete the program even under, as I said, under less than optimal circumstances. But this was, again, very, very effective because people said, well, even if this is the case and that is the case and Bush is really trying to do this over oil or for some other reason, it's a good thing to destroy his nuclear program. And I suppose it's still a fairly good argument. Now, having been conned into the war, because I really do feel we were conned into it, remember how close that Senate vote was, at least we could have hoped for a better account of the battle, such as it was. My editor, Lewis Lapham at Harper's, calls it the suppression of a mob. That's really a better description of the Gulf War. But the censorship was so extraordinary, and the media was so passive in the face of the censorship, that we didn't get a very good, in fact, we got a terrible view of what the war actually looked like and what occurred during the war. In my book, I interview people like Ben Bradley and Catherine Graham, who show a marked indifference to the whole thing. I can be more detailed later if you like. And you have to remember that freedom of the press, as A.J. Liebling wrote, is guaranteed only to those who own one. And therefore you have to understand that if Ben Bradley, or especially if Katherine Graham, doesn't care enough to do anything about it, nothing's going to get done. It's just not going to get done. The institutional opposition is just not going to happen. I could go into great detail about how the media bureaucrats in Washington colluded in their own demise. We can get into that more if you like, but it's a very, very sad and pathetic story, which I tell in some detail. Now, what is a poor citizen to do, given that you've got ambitious politicians that want to put one over on you, and you've got reporters that don't want to do anything about it, don't know how to ask questions, don't know how to do basic reporting anymore? And all I can advise you to do is to do your own reporting and reading. I mean, I don't like to give you a sense of hope. I don't want to give you a sense of hopelessness, because it's not hopeless. The best media critics were Liebling, H.L. Mencken, and Walter Karp, and I recommend all their books to you and all their articles. But what about the journalists themselves? What about the reporters themselves? As Rather had said, our kind of reporter, the kind of reporter I think of myself as being, and he fantasizes, he once was, because for Rather it's very much, to some extent, a pose of the tough guy reporter, you know, afraid of no one, ready to challenge power at every step. You know, why? Our type of reporter is virtually extinct. You know, the sort of reporter who really likes to put a politician's feet to the fire, who enjoys it, who has a kind of a mean streak. I'm going to speak to the University of California Journalism School tonight, and I'm going to say to the students, you know, how many of you really feel that you have the stomach for this, that you have the sort of mean streak, or that you get the joy out of making a politician angry that is required to do good journalism? But I mean, the situation just seems to get worse and worse. I don't know if any of you noticed, but Harper's, in conjunction with Nightline, broke a story in August about a document that seemed to show that George Bush strafed lifeboats in World War II. This is a document that was floating around in the media before the election, while Bush is bashing Clinton's draft dodging and trumpeting his own wartime achievements. And no one would publish it. Newsweek wouldn't publish it. U.S. News wouldn't publish it. They wouldn't even ask Bush for comment on it. Wouldn't even ask him for comment on it. And Harper's published it in the September issue. But believe me, we were not congratulated by my colleagues. In fact, I went on a couple of radio shows. It's a document that I happen to have acquired with the media critic of Newsweek, Jonathan Alter. Jonathan, who's supposed to be a media critic, spent a good 10 minutes explaining why the document was insignificant, so that at the end of the 5 minutes of this explication, I said, isn't it great to have the media critic for Newsweek magazine doing George Bush's explaining for him? But that's precisely what was going on during the Gulf War, during the buildup and during the Gulf War. 95% of the reporters were doing their damnedest to interpret or to help explicate the government's version of the war. That's what we do now. It's not even stenography. It's worse than stenography now. It's sort of extra public relations help. And through the Freedom of Information Act request, I was able to get this wonderful, it's in my book, this wonderful conversation between Pete Williams, the chief Pentagon spokesman, and his underlings in Tehran, where he says, he actually says, look, guys, you know, you may get some gripes from the reporters who feel unhappy about being confined to pools and not getting to the action and so on, but to tell you the truth, there's a good portion of them that are just doing this for show. They really want to help, sort of tweak it up a little bit, is the way he put it. So we're now in a situation where you've got powerful newspaper executives like Al Newharth, the former chairman of the Gannett chain, making idiotic statements like, quote, there are no more secrets in the world, from the, what was it, from the lowest, from the highest mountain to the lowest valley, I think, deepest valley. Connie Chung is, who's much more likable, I guess, than Dan Rather, is now his co-anchor. Pete Williams is a reporter. The guy who lied again and again during the Gulf War and lied directly to me. I can honestly call him a liar and never lose a libel suit. He's now a reporter for NBC. Bob Woodward, the hero of Watergate, sits on stories. One of the best stories of the pre-Gulf War period was the revelation, which we received in his book after the Gulf War, that Colin Powell opposed, alone in the administration, opposed military action, the military solution in the Gulf War. Now, I think that's something that would have informed the debate before the war, but he sat on the story, and it was left to Bob Edwards, our friend on Morning Edition, to say, well, isn't that a little odd? I mean, during Watergate, you broke stories as the story was unfolding. And Woodward gave some half-assed response about, well, it wasn't like any great crime was being committed. So, and moreover, on the, as I said, I'm speaking at the Berkeley J School tonight. What all this does is to discourage reporters or young people going to journalism from trying to do what I think is the right thing, which is to make trouble and get in trouble and get people mad at them on behalf of the public, and also, of course, get the public angry from time to time. But I'm afraid that if you polled most journalism students today, you'd find that a good number of them are hoping to become Sam Donaldson, who sat on the satellite photographs because he was too scared to go with them, or Diane Sawyer, who was an assistant press agent for Nixon. Does everybody know that she followed Nixon into exile for 2 years? Continued working for him after Watergate, rather than Seymour Hersh, who was one of my heroes, or and a real nasty son of a bitch, just broke a very good story in the New Yorker. Let's be fair. Or they want to be George Stephanopoulos, or even they even want to be a Hill and Knowlton PR executive. Because that's where the action is today. That's where the rewards are. Like Henrietta Stackpole, of course, I'm dedicated and to the notion that it's a great thing to be hated, or at least I accept it as part of the territory of being a serious reporter. And I think what could be better than to be hated by Frank Mankiewicz and Robert Gray of Hill and Knowlton, or for that matter by George Bush or Robert Stinnett, who's outraged that I'm speaking today. Stinnett was Bush's wartime biographer, and he's the guy who left the strafing report out of the biography. But what's a little disturbing is to be hated by my putative colleagues in the press, and I am hated by them because I go around attacking them and telling them that they're slobs and lazy and tools of the establishment and handmaidens to political power. And they hate me for it. But it's getting to the point where things are so polarized, I really don't have any choice but to do this, because to go around saying politicians are lying to you and you've got to beware, when I know that one of our big problems is that the reporters themselves are helping amplify the lies, I'm not giving you the whole story, and that's what I'm supposed to do as a journalist and a publisher. Nowadays, reporters or the courtiers in the press who want to be invited to parties at the White House or Jack Kent Cook's box at RFK Stadium. And they want to be loved both by the politicians, and this is paradoxical, they want to be loved by the politicians and by the masses, by the general public. They want celebrity and they want access to the halls of power. And ultimately, of course, as Jefferson said, and I'm paraphrasing, at some point in your life, one's life, one has to choose between the interests of the many and the interests of the few. And this balancing act is very dangerous for reporters and for editorial people, because at a certain point, if you choose the interests of the few too often and it gets exposed, it can bring you down. At least that's my hope. The only way your interest, the public interest, is ever going to be represented in the media as a result is if you get wise to what's going on and you let the media know that you're dissatisfied. it takes, I think, $100 million to start a daily newspaper, and good luck trying to beat the Chronicle and the Examiner monopoly. But there's got to be some way that you get your message across that you're not happy, you're not satisfied with the situation. That's the only hope.